Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of July. I'm your unexpected host, Charlie Fleischman, usually the engineer and editor and sometimes assistant reader of observations and upcoming events, filling all the roles for this broadcast. Today we're presenting an encore of a show that originally aired in October 2017. Former Nature Now host and local naturalist Ken Wilson spoke to environmental educator, writer, photographer, and naturalist Bob Steelquist to discuss interesting creatures and other features in our environment. But first, this week's mystery sound. Listen later in the program when the mystery sound is revealed. To start off observations for this week, we have a fascinating report provided by Nature Now producer and host Nan Evans. Last week's low tides took Wendy Feltham, Lee Merrill, and Nan on another expedition to the Marine Life Sanctuary at Salt Creek County Park, west of Port Angeles. The most common question that other visitors asked them during their 5 hours exploring the tide pools was, "Did you see any sea stars?" The basic answer was an unfortunate, "Only a few." None of the iconic ochre sea stars or the fascinating multi-armed and large sun stars were seen. Wendy, Lee, and Nan found only a few small gray six-armed stars and the bright orange blood stars. The day, however, was marked by lots of observations of various tide pool fish species. Every tide pool had its resident population of tide pool sculpin. Did you know that after every high tide, these small, 1 to 4 inch long tide pool sculpins returned to the same tide pool? The three explorers also found an emerald green fluffy sculpin active in the surf grass, a spectacularly lined and striped longfin sculpin, a mosshead war bonnet with its intricate crew-cut-like hairdo, a tiny baby northern clingfish, orange with a distinct white band across its head and specialized sucking disc derived from transformed pelvic fins, and an unusually brownish tide pool snailfish with its dorsal fin being one long low-lying fin down its back. But, by far, the most exciting fish find was a grunt sculpin. Neither Wendy, Lee, nor Nan had ever observed this little fish in the wild. The grunt sculpin is an oddly shaped little fellow with a pointy snout, an orangish tail, and pectoral fins which can mimic a feeding barnacle. The grunt sculpin appeared in a tide pool where the three were spending some time watching and trying to identify the longfin sculpin, again showing that the more you watch, the more you see. And I'd like to add a few personal observations. Because of my proximity to the Port Townsend Golf Course, I like to walk around the perimeter of the layout when conditions and lack of golfers permit. The important natural feature of the course, of course, is the Cotai Prairie Preserve, which is bisected by the road that leads into the course from Blaine Street. Deborah Kelso and guest Fred Sharp spoke about the preserve's beauty and diversity on Nature Now last week, and it's an easy place to access when no one is hitting a small round ball on the adjacent holes. It's best to walk in from Cherry Street, which allows you to see if anyone's on the course at the moment, or park in the parking lot and check if the coast is clear before walking around the white chain-link fence that delineates the preserve. The Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society does a remarkable job of maintaining and enhancing the site, and it's worth the effort to seek it out. While you're in that area, you'll be treated to one of the best local views of the Olympics, especially on days when there are numerous cumulus white clouds like the ones that appeared on several days last week. Go when it's nearing sunset and enjoy the sometimes spectacular colors that highlight the cloud formations. Also, that's when the golfers are mostly through for the day, making it easier to check out the preserve. And if you poke around the edges of the course early or late in the day, you'll see a great deal of poison hemlock. This year saw an explosion in the number of plants, some as tall as 12 or 14 feet, and the reduction is extremely important. Joost Bessen of the Noxious Weed Control Board was Mary Robson's Nature Now guest a few weeks ago and he mentioned the board has a removal project that will eliminate as much of the hemlock as possible. Walking around last week, I noticed the work is progressing, and the result can especially be seen in the areas where the hemlock was most dense. Now to the main feature of today's show, Ken Wilson and Bob Steelquist discuss interesting creatures and other features in our environment.
Hi, I'm Ken Wilson, and I'm here with Robert Steelquist, who is one of our local authors and quite prominent as one of our Northwest's notable naturalist educators. Over a period of more than 30 years, Robert has written about Washington's geography, nature, salmon, and other topics ranging from mountain summits to ocean depths. Robert has a keen mind for understanding and communicating scientific concepts. He has a very deep appreciation of nature, a splendid eye for photography. We met briefly a couple of months ago, and I knew he'd be someone we'd want to interview for Nature Now, so thanks for being here, Robert.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure.
And I do want to mention that, for example, I have Robert's most recent book, and that he does not treat living things and nature merely as stuff to identify, but instead as a world to notice far more closely, using more of your senses, enjoying yourself, understanding it scientifically, and definitely to conserve.
My experience primarily comes as an environmental educator for 30 plus, almost 40 years. And I really, through my own education, both schooling, graduate degrees, and my experience, realized that we as humans begin understanding things through experience, not just facts.
Yes. And your latest book, which came out last year, is titled The Northwest Coastal Explorer, Your Guide to the Places, Plants, and Animals of the Pacific Coast. So much emphasis for the average tourist is on what are sometimes referred to as charismatic megafauna. And here in the Northwest, we certainly are enamored with our megafauna, such as orcas or elk. Some of these critters are fascinating or beautiful or important, but not necessarily of the charismatic megafauna category. What for you are some overlooked living things here in the Northwest that are charismatic to you? And maybe we can look at seashore life as a starting point.
To me, what's really most important are the things that live around us that give us day-to-day reminders that we are part of nature. And the Northwest has a phenomenal nature to offer us. In fact, that's why most of us have chosen to live here. The common things are really, really important. These are the things that drive the biological and ecological processes that make our place what it is. That being said, as our knowledge, our understanding, as our skill expands, we seek out the things that are more rare. But in this book in particular, I really was aiming for the things that folks see but don't quite understand, but that are right around them. Banana slug, for example, sword fern for another, cedar trees. These things have profound influence on the ecology, the ecological processes of the place we live. Furthermore, as we begin to get hints of changes, these are the things that are going to signal those changes. My goal was really to reintroduce us all to the things that are close at hand.
Okay, well, let's look at some fun ones I enjoyed in your book. How many books of living things of the Northwest would have an entire little mini chapter on the lugworm or beach hopper? So tell us about lugworms.
Lugworms live in estuary mudflats. Estuaries appear to us when the tide is out to be barren. They're just these big, broad flats of mud. And yet what is going on there is phenomenally important in terms of biological diversity. Lugworms actually live down in this stuff. They are constantly digesting nutrients. They're reprocessing and recycling. They're turning over nutrients, releasing nutrients into the water column so that they drift around, and they form just incredible balls of energy for the other higher order organisms that
like sandpipers.
Like sandpipers, like shorebirds. Mudflats in our estuaries are the truck stops for these millions of migrating shorebirds every year that make this trip. And they have to hop estuary to estuary,
right,
spend a few tidal cycles, and gather up all the food they can. Lugworms are a real good example.
And what about beach hoppers? So what's a beach hopper? Are they some kind of little sand flea?
Sand fleas. First of all, they have to live in a narrow band where there's not so much water in the sand that they drown, and the sand isn't so dry that their tunnels collapse. So they burrow in the sand, and then they scurry out, they come out, you can find them under piles of debris like kelp. They're breaking down these processes. These are scavengers, they're detritivores, they're eating bits and pieces. They're pretty interesting, really. They can jump many times their body length. They are so common, we see them, we take them for granted. It's really worthwhile to stop, see them, watch them burrow into the sand, dig as fast as they can
right.
go. It's going, going, gone.
And they're probably responsible for the disappearance of all those millions of tons of seaweed that wash up in the fall.
They certainly play their part, yes.
Yeah. So now, next topic, edibles. So you say that goose barnacles are a delicacy, for example, in Spain and Portugal, and have actually been over-harvested. Have you eaten any goose barnacles?
I have. I've had the privilege of being treated to goose barnacles by my friends in Nia Bay. They're also a delicacy in northwestern coastal tribes, have been for a long time. They go by the name of boots. They're harvested. They have a long stalk, and inside them is a little pinky finger size piece of meat that's very, very sweet and very, very delicate. They're very dangerous to harvest because they live in very dangerous
right.
places.
Yeah. A story you were sharing with me just a little bit before our interview had to do with magnetite covering the tongue, or what scientifically is referred to as the radula of a gumboot chitin. So why don't you expand on that?
It's one of those factoids that is just kind of mind-blowing. Chitons spend their lives crawling around. They have 8 plates that protect them. They have a single foot. They crawl around and they eat algae. So they have a radula, a rasp-like tongue, that grinds this off the rocks or whatever surface they're on. Scientists have discovered that they're tiny bits of magnetite, basically iron or something like steel, within the teeth, particularly the front 2 teeth of the chitin. The phenomenal part of this is that when we think of steel and iron, we think of enormous amounts of energy, heat, and pressure it takes to create steel.
Right.
And it took humans a long time to figure out how to take a lump of ore
right.
and apply heat to it and apply pressure and pound it and work it and work it and work it and turn it into just a lump of iron. Then it took humans centuries to figure out how to add carbon to that to make it into steel. One of the things that we're seeing, and it's kind of this nanobio process that occurs in chitons, is that they are able to use trace bits of iron that is in algae. They're able, through chemical changes within their body, they're able to synthesize and create ionic exchanges in that iron. There's a carbohydrate filament kind of in their tissues that allows iron atoms to attract to one another and actually then plate these little teeth on the radula. So what takes us centuries and centuries and centuries
right.
to figure out, and enormous amounts of energy for the production of iron and steel, this organism has created chemically and biologically over its hundreds of millions of years of evolution.
That's amazing. So I've got some little notes scribbled here, and one has to do with some peculiar reproductive strategies, and you talk about the aggregating anemone.
we can clone plants. Apple trees, for example, we get apples that are true to the variety only when we really clone a scion wood onto a rootstock. So we know that cloning works in the plant kingdom. In the animal kingdom, cloning works as well. And aggregating anemones are actually able to reproduce identical genetic copies of themselves into colonies. And so they actually tear themselves apart. If you look at these little quarter and half dollar sized green and pink aggregating anemones on a tide pool rock, sometimes you'll find one that's in the process of just stretching apart and cloning. So they reproduce. They also recognize their own kind. And then where they encounter in this endless competition for space that we see in the rocky intertidal zone, where they encounter another clone, they actually form kind of a little no man's land.
Like an inch across or so.
Yeah, an inch across or even closer, where they're all just crowding up to this line and they won't mix.
Because they know that the others are the enemy, the different clone.
The anemone. Yeah. Yes.
Those particular anemones, those are the ones that are sort of when you're walking across tide pools with mixed with boulders and sand and your foot comes down on something squishy.
You often won't recognize them because at low tide, they will cover themselves with debris, shell fragments, sand and things, and you may not see them. They're much smaller than the green anemones that we're most familiar with seeing.
Yeah. I was also impressed to learn some of the growth rates of some of these creatures. Bull kelp can grow up to 6 inches in a day. How do we explain that?
This is an annual plant. It's a brown algae. It basically has one growing season to reach what may be 70 feet of water depth to bring its stipes or its blades up to the surface where it can collect sunlight and photosynthesize. At the end of that growing season, it dies. And actually, that's when bull kelp really begins to show life and its role in the ecological community.
And supports a whole food web of other critters.
Precisely, and provides shelter. So when we're offshore, late in the season, we often see what we call kelp patties, or these big mats of tangled bull kelp. These are floating islands, and they provide refuge, shade, and cover from predators for lots of different larvae, fish, invertebrate larvae, juvenile fishes, and juvenile forms of invertebrates. So the kelp lives on in another role. And then, of course, when we see the kelp forest, it's the equivalent of the rainforest, really, in our nearshore environment.
Yeah. When we talk about those floating islands of kelp and being cover, but also a food source, it reminds me of something else you'd written about. The reproductive potential of some of these creatures is phenomenal. You mentioned purple shore crabs, which are less than 2 inches across, laying 30,000 eggs. Of course, the vast, vast majority of those are eaten by other creatures. The reproductive potential is supporting an immense food web. It seems as if purple shore crab eggs are the reason why we have orcas, you can almost exaggerate.
Well, purple shore crabs and practically everything else. Evolution has shown every species, every organism, the best way to perpetuate itself. In birds and mammals, we have strategies that really focus parental attention on a single or a few offspring. But in the vast majority of cases in nature, the game is to produce as many as you can on the hopes that a tiny fraction of those will reach maturity, reproductive age.
And being a birder, which I am and have been since, 50 or so years, it's widely known, and perhaps incorrectly, that birds basically are visual creatures in terms of finding food and that the sense of smell is very poorly developed. And you mention how a particular chemical, dimethyl sulfide, is actually significant to seabirds. Maybe explain some of this.
In order to find enough to eat out in the ocean, You've got to use all the tools that you've been provided. And evolution has provided certain seabirds with very, very unique mechanisms that involve feeding or the ingestion of water. One of these is the ability of certain seabirds to actually smell and detect the kinds of scents that are being given off by plankton and decomposing plankton that they depend on. Other mechanisms that are equally important is in pelagic seabirds, especially the ability to rid their bodies of salt. So we see variations that allow organisms, particularly in this case seabirds, the ability to survive in these places, find what they need to eat and survive.
We could go on and on about intertidal life and that whole zone. And then because you're also fascinated with and expert with terrestrial environments, you had a note in your book about geology, how I believe it was the San Juan Islands are actually formed from an ancient archipelago crashing into North America.
Well, actually, the entire western U.S., west of the Rockies, has been formed by a series of island arc or small continents, we call them terranes, that have moved through the process of plate tectonics and over millions of years have been accreted on to the North American continental edge. So the Okanagan Highlands in eastern Washington, the Central Cascades, that is the Cascades that form the foundation for the more recent volcanoes, are composed of these exotic terrains that collided with the continent. The Olympics are the most recent example we can point to here. The Olympics basically are seafloor basalt and seafloor sedimentary rock that crashed into the North American plate,
right,
some of which was drawn under and drives the volcanic mountains of the Cascades. But in the Olympics, we had an interesting thing happen, is that the subduction process choked. Parts of the Olympics did not go down and popped up instead and just kind of got tumbled and deformed into the forms that we see in the Olympic mountains now.
Okay. And on another note, tell us about fog drip.
Well, fog is a form of precipitation that's pretty subtle. I mean, we all know that we can go out and our Gore-Tex is going to get damp if we're walking around in the fog. I like to think of fog drip as a process that is oceanic in its nature, its origin. And basically, for our conifer forests, fog drip is really essential as a way that moisture enters into the terrestrial ecosystem, the process of living plants. Every conifer is basically composed of millions of small leaves. We call them needles. And each of these basically is a little surface that can capture very, very tiny droplets of moisture. So we're familiar with the phenomenon in a rainstorm in, say, the Ho River Valley. We'll get rain, and then the forest will drip for a day or more afterward as that water pours out. Well, the same thing is happening with fog. Trees, conifers in particular, harvest fog. That's one of the main ways that they bring moisture into the forest. And when you look at the coast redwoods of California, you look at the Sitka spruce of the northwestern coast here in Washington and further north, these are really important sources of moisture in the rainforest. I would say rainforest may be a misnomer. I would more likely characterize these as fog forests, where precipitation, especially in the summertime when we get low coastal fogs, makes its way inland, is captured in the forest ecosystem, and then just feeds and nourishes.
Drips down to the ground and feeds the roots.
Precisely.
I'm impressed with how much you've picked up from so many different places and ecosystems. As a sort of closure, maybe you can list some favorite places and why, maybe a favorite or a best place for seeing sea otters or pelicans or a beach walk you love.
Sea otters are one of our best conservation success stories. Sea otters were extirpated in the early 20th century. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist named Carl Kenyon, late 60s and early 70s, single-handedly pretty much took it upon himself to salvage some otters that would likely have died in nuclear tests in the Aleutians. and brought sea otters to the Washington coast. The first batch were lost. They were not transported properly. But sea otters now exceed 1,000 in the population of the Washington coast. Best place to see them. There are big rafts off of Cape Alava. Take your spotting scope with you.
Oh, okay. So you need a spotting scope.
Spotting scope is good because they're hard to detect among kelp beds. Sea otters are the ones that are like little barges. The kelp is the one with just the bulb one end. Cape Flattery is another nice spot because at Cape Flattery, you will often see sea otters moving right around Cape Flattery. One of the places that I got the most delight was going up to Botanical Beach in British Columbia. It's really worth the drive off the Vancouver Island coast and getting up to Port Renfrew and looking at Botanical Beach. I really urge people to go there.
Perfect. I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks to Ken and Bob for providing a new way to look at many of the things around us. Here's the mystery sound once more. It's the great blue heron, the iconic large wading bird seen near the shores of open water and near wetlands. The bird is a common symbol in the Northwest, and sculptures and paintings of these beautiful large creatures can be found everywhere. Herons usually nest in trees or bushes near the water's edge to protect against predators. Their primary food is small fish, although they'll take the opportunity to feed on shrimp, crabs, aquatic insects, rodents, reptiles, ducklings, and more, when available. They rarely venture far from bodies of water, but sometimes can be seen flying over upland areas. If you see one flying overhead, you'll always recognize it by its amazing wingspan. Finally, we have some upcoming events and some opportunities to get out there to learn and do. On Saturday, July 21st, 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., go with the Admiralty Audubon Society to the Duckabush Oxbow Preserve, one of the Jefferson Land Trust's most spectacular properties. See mergansers, dippers, flycatchers, and warblers in their last act of parenting of the year and learn about the restoration and development planned for this beautiful area. Go to the Admiralty Audubon website for details. On Tuesday, July 24th, 9:45 a.m., Jefferson Land Trust needs your help to pull and chop Scott's broom away from a former home site deep within the Duckabush Riparian Forest Preserve. Visit the Land Trust website for details and contact information. And the same week, on Thursday, July 26th, the Washington Native Plant Society has a maximum 5-mile hike to Badger Valley to view dozens of subalpine to alpine species blooming at this time. Check the new website at wnps2.org, that's the number 2, and look for the Olympic Peninsula chapter link. That's all for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you enjoy our weekly look at the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptc.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Thursdays at 5:05 p.m., and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thank you for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
This week's closing music is Foggy Mountain Breakdown, performed by Earl Scruggs.